Maybe the United States was never really finished in Iraq. Regardless, events of the past 2 weeks have returned that nation to a front and center position for Congress and the administration. Paul Bremer was U.S. presidential envoy to Iraq in 2003 and 2004. A career diplomat, he was thrust into the spotlight as temporary head of the Iraqi government after the fall of Saddam Hussein. Most of the questions this week have been about military options now that the government is under threat. We've asked Bremer about how this affects the State Department, both here and in Baghdad.
My experience, both in Iraq and before that, in almost a quarter century as a professional diplomat, is that you can never, should never disconnect the political part of a foreign policy from the military part. They're interrelated. I worked on NATO affairs for a number of years, and the presence of American troops in Europe was an important element when I was serving as ambassador in the Netherlands or as chargé in Norway. It was an important element of our overall strategy. So the present crisis in Iraq needs a political leg under the stool. The president and his administration have, again, I think correctly, said that we should be pushing for a broader-based government in Iraq, broader than just al-Maliki and the Shiites. That's basically diplomacy. That's what that calls for. And we have an ambassador in Iraq. My view, my personal view, is this is really a time for the Secretary of State. We need weight to make this political solution come. I found, as all of my successors in Iraq have found, all the ambassadors, that the Iraqis can only be brought to some kind of a understanding through American presence and American influence and effectively us brokering a deal. That's really diplomacy at the very basic level, and that's what we need now in Iraq.
So the Secretary of State might swoop in and sort of commandeer or negotiate the diplomacy at the very top level. Meanwhile, there are roughly 5,000 people in the country working on behalf of the American government. What do they do in these types of situations?
First of all, I do think it is at this point a job for the Secretary of State, and it's not so much swooping in, to use your term. I mean, he needs to go there and stay there, and it ought to be done in private. Diplomacy almost always works better in private than in public, and I think personally some of the statements being backgrounded out of the White House in the last few days are probably not very helpful. It doesn't help very much to bang al-Maliki over the head publicly as a diplomatic process to get him to agree. In any case, what the other people are doing and what Secretary Kerry would rely very much on is the professional, political, and economic experts who are at that big embassy who can help him figure out how do we help the Iraqis bridge their differences, knowing what we know about the policy. We've been there now for 11 years. We know a lot, certainly a lot more than I knew or we knew when I got there. We know a lot about how Iraqi politics work, which are the sects that do this, which groups, which tribes in the Sunni area are likely to be more likely to join a broader government and which will be irremediably be against a broader government. Our experts know those kinds of things, and they're working in the embassy. They're obviously working back here, both in the State Department, the CIA, and other places. Secretary Kerry, if he were to decide to go over there, would have to rely very much on this kind of expertise that lies deep in the State Department.
Looking at the situation as it's unfolding, the question comes up, is this a result partly of an air gap between administrations where maybe there should have not been such a clean or difficult break?
It's hard to say without – I mean, I think that's a question historians will want to pore over the documents to get a good answer to. I think there was an intentional gap by the incoming Obama administration because President Obama had, as a senator, opposed the war in Iraq. So it was somewhat logical that he would take a different view than his predecessor. That's not unusual in my experience in transitions between presidencies. I saw five or six during my time in government. I don't think there was an air gap. I don't think it was a communications problem. I think there was an intentional switch of strategy.
But now I think the problem or the situation comes about, and many of us are wondering, what is the responsibility that the United States has, given that we've been there for the last dozen or so years?
Well, I actually approached that question from a slightly different angle. To me, the question is, irrespective of what went before, what are American interests today, right now? That is what should drive national security policy. And the president said about a week ago that it was in America's interest that this ISIS, this terrible, world's worst terrorist group, not get a foothold in Iraq. And Chairman Dempsey said on Wednesday that we should go after ISIS anywhere we find it. So, and I think that's right. I think that is our immediate interest, is to stabilize the situation in Iraq, irrespective of what went before. The historians will debate that long after we've all gone. But right now we have a real problem. We have a problem in Iraq, and we have a longer-term, bigger problem in stabilizing the region. We have to address the first one if we're ever going to get to address the second one.
We're speaking with L. Paul Bremer. He was the U.S. presidential envoy to Iraq in 2003 and 2004. And what about the government and the daily functions in Iraq? What do you imagine it's like now, the administrative day-to-day things? I guess people still try to get driver's license or water bills, that kind of thing. Does that pretty much still continue, or do you think that's maybe dissolving too?
I think as long as the terrorists are kept north of Baghdad, most of the ministries in Baghdad, don't forget the ministries also have provincial offices in places like Mosul and Tikrit and other places. So you'd have to ask yourself, are we talking about the headquarters or the other offices? I think they will probably turn over relatively normally, although obviously if the terrorists start to threaten Baghdad itself, there will be a natural reduction in that. It's interesting, during the time I was there, 2003 and 2004, we didn't have a large-scale insurgency. What we had was al-Qaeda conducting terrorist attacks, although at the time we didn't know what it was. We learned in January 2004 it was al-Qaeda. The ministries, even though all of the ministers had fled the country before I got there, the people who had been in charge of each of the ministries.
And they were all Sunnis.
Well, they were mostly Sunnis. Mostly. There were some others. When I went and I visited all the ministries, I went and met with the ministers who had been appointed by the interim Iraqi government, and I talked to the career people who'd been there, many of them 30 or 40 years, the way you'd find it in the American government. I found them, on the whole, pretty much on top of their decisions, pretty much ready to help. There was one big problem, which was understandable. If you live under the kind of brutal dictatorship that Saddam had, and you're a civil servant, you're a director general in the Ministry of Irrigation, you learn very quickly not to take chances. So that we complain in our government about our government being all tied up, State Department's always complaining about being tied up with the clearance process. Well, it's nothing compared to what the Iraqi clearance process was, because that director general knew that if he made a mistake, if he gave a point to Saddam was wrong, it was literally his life. So he would consult with 10, 15, 20 different people, get everybody's signature on the piece of paper before it went up to the Revolution Council for decision, hoping that by having spread the responsibility wide enough, he might protect himself. And one of the problems we had was getting the Iraqis who were competent to take decisions, take some initiative. And we had advisors in each of the ministries to help them see that this was what we wanted. We didn't want to have the old Saddam system.
I want to return for a moment to sort of think about what those Americans in Iraq are doing right now. Of course, we know that this militant group has ambitions that exceed Iraq. You know, they're also looking at Syria and in the neighboring area. So how do those missions, those U.S. missions on the ground in the area, have to work together? Because what happens in Iraq has repercussions elsewhere.
Yes, that's true. One of the things that I'm sure is going on is that you have a lot of analyses being produced by, for example, the embassy in Jordan. We don't have an embassy in Syria anymore, but an embassy in Jordan, the embassy in Lebanon, the embassy in Turkey, where you have analyses coming from those diplomats who've been out talking to members of the government, to journalists, to businessmen in, say, Jordan, about how they view the situation in the region, in Iraq and Syria. And those analyses will be coming back by email. We used to have telegrams in the old days when I was there. And being integrated by the regional bureau in the State Department, it's called the Bureau of Near Eastern Affairs, which will then say, well, here's what the guys in Jordan are saying, here's what the guys in Beirut are saying, here's what the guys in Ankara are saying. So, Mr. Secretary, here's our considered view of what the situation regionally looks like. And that, as I mentioned at the top of our talk, eventually we're going to have to address the question of the regional security. The immediate one is Iraq, but eventually we're going to have to get the region.
And given the fact that they, as well as CIA operatives and others working on behalf of the government, have been working all along, how much of this should be actually a surprise to those gathering the information and sending it back to the Near East Bureau?
Well, I think the surprise in the last few months has been how quickly the American-trained Iraqi army collapsed. I think there's no question, and you have seen press reports that the government was surprised. I think the reason for that is that al-Maliki basically replaced American-trained officers, sometimes even down to the battalion level, with people who were characterized more by loyalty to him than by military competence. And anybody who knows the military knows it's the leadership of the unit that matters. If you don't trust the guy, the major or the captain who's leading you, you very quickly put down your arms and skedaddle. And that may be the explanation for how quickly these three divisions collapsed in northern Iraq.
And a personal question, because we sometimes encounter people that were career federal employees, managers, as you were, but sometimes they get close to the maelstrom and get sucked up into a very big and visible position, as you did, as you know, the provisional authority in Iraq. What does that do to you as a former long-term career person? How does that change your perspective?
Well, first of all, I have only myself to blame because I said yes to the president. I actually believe that every American, no American can say no to the president of the United States unless he's got some major family or other personal reasons. So when the president asked me, I said yes, because I believe in public service. I will have to say it turned out to be harder than I thought it was going to be. I think that was true of everybody in our government. It certainly turned out to be harder. It obviously put a new, even though I had been ambassador a number of times, it put a new perspective because under international law, we were the occupying power, and therefore, effectively, I was the executive, legislative, and judicial authority in Iraq under occupation law. I don't know why we ever used the term occupation. You have to ask a lawyer. It's a terrible idea. But that was a fact. So I had a breadth of responsibility that was an order of magnitude more than I had exercised as an ambassador. It was very hard.
And you still talk to Don Rumsfeld occasionally, ever?
Yes, when I see him, sure.
What lesson would you like to impart to those who have to figure this whole situation out now, drawing from your experience back then?
Well, I think we go back to what I said earlier, that the guideline for what we do should be a hard-headed analysis of American interests. That really is what should be the basis of a relatively useful foreign policy, national security policy. And I use the term national security policy because it's always going to be beyond just diplomacy. It's not just diplomacy. It's going to have a military and intelligence aspect. I think the president has correctly identified our immediate interest about not letting Iraq fall to these terrorists. So you start from there, and then you say, therefore what? And the analysis should be relatively cold-blooded. You say, okay, if that's our interest, what do we do? And then presumably, if you're working for the president or on the National Security Council, you give him a set of recommendations about what he might consider, which is, I understand, what he's doing now.